the UCR Podcast.
It has been an unbelievable time, Triumph fans. It was about 2 weeks ago today, as I'm speaking to you, that I first heard the initial word that Triumph would be doing a reunion tour. I had not heard any tour dates or any other particulars, just that it was going to be happening. And if you've been following this story for the past nearly 20 years, you know that these guys have been really transparent that they wanted to do a reunion tour after they played the two concerts that they did in Sweden and Oklahoma back in 2008. It did not come together, and in their collective opinion, the time had come and gone to make it happen. Outside of a couple of isolated performances more recently, including a surprise one that was filmed for their documentary and a pretty high-profile appearance performing in Edmonton prior to Game 2 of the Stanley Cup playoffs back in June, Triumph as a band has been on ice, existing only in the form of catalog reissues and things like that. So it's been a very happy surprise to get the reunion news, and I was pleased to get an invite to sit down with Rick Emmett, Mike Levine, and Gil Moore to talk about what fans can expect from the upcoming shows. I'm going to say this up front because Gil's been talking so much in recent years about the mixed reality concept that he was working on to bring Triumph back to the stage virtually. I think that there has been some confusion that started almost immediately as soon as the tour was announced, and people started searching on Google and so on, and they were getting AI search results that said this tour is something that it is not. So to that end, I'm going to share a statement with you from the band. If you have not seen this, it'll help to offer some clarity. Here's the statement. We want to clear up something that popped up during today's tour announcement. This is not a tribute band tour. This is a Triumph tour. We're putting in the work to bring out our show and our songs back to you, the fans, and to help us deliver a truly world-class show. We'll be joined on stage by a few friends, Todd Kearns and Brent Fitz from Slash's band, and Phil X on loan from the mighty Bon Jovi. Big things ahead. We can't wait to share it with you. See you on the road, Gil, Rick, and Mike. There you have it, straight from the band, and we discuss all of this in today's interview, including how Phil, Todd, and Brent will be integrated into the live performances. Plus, we talk about a lot of other subjects as well, including how this tour came together, of course, but also we dig into the history behind some of Triumph's classic songs, including Magic Power and Lay It on the Line, as well as thoughts on their 1976 debut album, which turns 50 next year. Tickets for the Rock and Roll Machine Reloaded 50th Anniversary Tour go on sale this Friday, December 12th, which will be tomorrow for a lot of you who are hearing this. And you can find everything that you need to know about getting tickets for the shows, which will also feature April Wine, at the band's official website, triumphmusic.com. My thanks to my longtime buddy Chip for helping to coordinate this conversation. And big thanks, of course, to Rick, Mike, and Gil for taking the time to talk through all of this stuff. Please enjoy our conversation with Triumph. I'm part of a generation that never got to see Triumph live, and I think there's at least a couple of generations now that can say that. So this is a bucket list moment for us as fans. How does the moment feel for you guys? Like, what are the thoughts and emotions that are within you three as we sit here talking about this today?
Since we're not starting till April, I guess it's hard to feel really emotional about it yet, other than the headaches that we will go through to prepare for April. But it's exciting in its own way, for sure.
You know, you prefaced the question by saying, oh, bucket list thing for people. I think that we're anticipating that energy as something that's going to make it a special thing for us, an interesting, you know, an inspiring, motivating, energizing thing. But if you're asking me right now, I think I'm shitting my pants. I'm not sure that what have I said yes to? Oh, no. You know, like, it's a big mountain to climb. And, you know, I'm 72 years old. I have doubts. I'm going to need guys like Matt Wardlaw to make me feel like I can do this. I can make this happen.
That's awesome. You know, I go back roughly 30 years with your PR guy, Chip, and he and I were on the phone. Somewhere in the midst of the phone call, he says to me, this is what we've both been hoping for a lot of years. And I hadn't thought about it that way. But for as long as I've been working with Chip, we've been on this Triumph journey with a lot of releases, but there was no Triumph. So let's start there. Like, outside of two concerts in 2008 and the subsequent tour that was talked about but didn't happen, for close to 20 years, the idea of a tour was seemingly off the table, and you all have been very transparent about that. So what changed, guys?
Yeah, it's serendipity. It's there's no one specific thing, Matt. Like, I think there's, I would say it's the rising tide of fans reflecting on how songs that Triumph played affected them in their life. And the more time goes by, the more of these stories you hear, and the more compelling they are, or in some cases, heart-wrenching. And so there's that cumulative effect that we're experiencing. Also, I would say that's across the backdrop of what we're seeing develop in communities and in societies around the world, both with, you know, the terrible things of man's inhumanity to man transpiring in various regions, combined with, you know, the fantastic breakthroughs in science and breakthroughs in technology. So these massive changes in the world. I don't know, maybe I'm being too vague, or I'm circling around here, but I guess I think there's just a consensus that we felt like maybe the songs we need to listen to our fans. They took the songs, they're their songs. You know, we may have recorded them and written them, but they're their songs, and they're sending us a strong message. They want to hear them again. It's the least I think we can do to give it our best shot. You know, it may not be perfect, but what's perfect anyway? You know, we're a rock and roll band. We're going to go out there and we're going to light it up absolutely the best way we know how.
Gil's answer is outside in. And I think maybe the question you're asking is also for inside out. And I do want to make sure that, you know, Triumph fans understand Gilmour never stops cooking and planning ideas for blowing up the world, you know, in his own inimitable fashion through Triumph. Like, the production is something that he constantly kind of is, that never goes away. He's always thinking about, hey, what if we did this? What if we did that? What if we... You know, and I think it's his life. He's got a production company. He's got a school. He's got a studio. He's always around this stuff that there's, I think, more energy to drive him back out on the road than me and Mike, you know, from an idea of a big band, you know, put the rock and roll machine back together and let's take it out on the road, you know. So that from the inside out, there's always that little bit of, you know, mental energy, you know, push.
Timeline-wise, where did this start, you guys? Like, how far back does this go as far as when did this start to seriously become a consideration? And have you guys been rehearsing? Obviously, we saw the performance prior to Game 2 of the Stanley Cup, which that seems like that would have offered an opportunity with Phil X and Brent and Todd to kind of road test things a little bit. But I just wondered, really, from a preparation standpoint, what all that has looked like. And perhaps, Gil, I'll direct that to you to start, if you'd like.
Well, I guess, you know, putting the band back together started with, a bad idea that I had. But you have to start somewhere. And our lighting director, Paul Dexter, from back in the day, was at the forefront of sort of 3D technology. And he had done a hologram tour with Ronnie Dio from Sabbath. And then he did another one with Frank Zappa. I went to see the Zappa tour and looked at what was going on. And then we chatted, and I told him, I said, this wouldn't work for Triumph. And he agreed with me. And even though it was really cool what he was doing with Frank Zappa, I will say, and with Ronnie, but it wouldn't work for Triumph. So we set out on a voyage, a technical voyage, to try to figure out what would work. And we sort of found ourselves in this world of mixed reality, which we've developed now for 6 years. And we've changed many aspects of the technology as technology has changed, because, as you know, whatever you knew 6 months ago is now, you know, somewhat obsolete. And you know, there's a new sheriff in town technically. And so the other thing that happened is, again, while there's that backdrop, but then we get this kind of really cool thing where, you know, hockey is such a big thing up here in Canada, and Lay It on the Line was selected by the NHL and the National the Sportsnet and Rogers and that whole MLSE organization, just all of them, for they just simultaneously seemed to jump on, lay it on the line, which then put it out there that, well, would you guys come and play for an NHL game? Well, being a kid myself who always wanted to be in the NHL, that was my goal. I didn't want to be a musician. I want to be a hot left wing, but thought this is going to be really cool. And it gave us a shot to try playing with some of the new musicians that we wanted to play with and bring Phil back into the band. And I figured, Phil X and Rick Emmett, that's a double-barreled shotgun if I ever saw one. So we went out and played there. And then that sort of lights up Live Nation. And then Live Nation shows up at the party and goes, we need to do a tour. And I guess the feedback again, like the fans, their reaction to the whole hockey thing, and it kind of gets at you, and you kind of feel like, well, kind of it's now or never, and maybe this needs to happen. And Paul's technology is really cooking now. We're going to be able to do some really cool theatrical moments on stage, and it was just like, okay, I think it's time to, it's time to light the fuse. Let's just go. It just seemed right.
For you guys, having done the two shows in Sweden and Oklahoma back in 2008, can you contrast a little bit what that felt like versus what you guys did in Edmonton? That had to be an interesting contrast. Rick, I know that, for example, you guys had Dave for those two shows in 2008, and you have had such an interesting relationship collaboratively with Dave over the years. And I think that's what's always interesting to me, is that whether you're a guitar player or whatever you play, like, it's always interesting to kind of find that new mix and find that new groove with somebody, be it Dave or in this case now, Phil X. So, like, it has to be pretty interesting for you starting to get to know Phil in that way.
Absolutely, yes. And the thing about collaborating with other musicians is, like, Triumph had been, traditionally this relatively insulated kind of, a power trio is a power trio. And that, I mean, going back to the Rush thing, you lose Neil and they go, well, it's done, And but then you go, well, maybe it's not done, because I think Alex and Geddy got together and started playing stuff, and then they went, this is fun. These songs are fun, and it's fun to play with you. I like that. Now, I've always liked the idea of a new musician, a new that the kind of the challenge of it, the fun of I like when music in a live situation has some jamming in it, some just impromptu kinds of exploration that are going on. And Phil is a crazy man. He's a force of nature kind of player, So I'm looking forward to that. It's not like we're sitting around rehearsing and working things out yet, but we are having these conversations about set lists and what songs and what things and which songs are gonna, explode and have different things happen in them. Give these guys, before I played in Edmonton with Todd, I knew very little about it, but now I follow him on, his social media, and I'm like, I'm a huge fan of this guy, and his potential is like through the roof. And I'm thinking, I could get like a Barca lounger, and I could just be relaxed, have a, one of those drinks with an umbrella in it, and I could just go, Todd, would you like to, take over? Like, I, it's the potential is really exciting. But we're not, it's not like we're sitting around. At some point, we're going to have to, fly everybody in and get everybody together in a room and, bash it together for a couple of weeks. But yeah, I think it's going to be a triumph that no one's ever seen before, that has never existed before. It's going to be something new and different. And I find that, yeah, okay, this is exciting.
I'll stay with you for a second, Rick. Like, how did that feel, the Edmonton thing? Because that had to be a really interesting feeling. Because, like I said, you guys had Dave, but it's like this time you basically add, you add three guys into the mix.
Yes.
That essentially, outside of Phil, which obviously Mike and Gil had played with Phil, but you're from your side, Rick, you've got three guys that you have very little experience with. And it's like, that's, it's fascinating to get in a room in a situation like that to see what comes out. And obviously, it's a whole different thing when you're then doing it in front of people with that same grouping. So that it had to be fascinating in that regard.
It was, and you know, there's a terrifying part of it because you're flying by the seat of your pants when you know, we had one rehearsal essentially, you know, before we went and did three songs. So there was an element there of, oh my God, this is terrifying, you know. But you know, you mentioned Dave Dunlop earlier. Like Dave and I, we played Triumph songs for decades, you know, like every night we had to get up and do Magic Power and fight and you know. And we made an album even then again that had acoustic duo with, you know, keyboard supplement versions of the Triumph stuff because we played them every night. So that stuff, when you're rehearsing with new guys, I go, hey, here's a shortcut to something good in a Triumph song that Dave Dunlop and I figured out. This will be good. So in the rehearsal, I'm taking advantage of, he's Dunlop's not there, but I'm taking advantage of, you know, the time that I've worked with him in order to get to a place with Phil in a hurry. You know, we recently did a thing where we played the Triumph got inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and we played with a house band, and it was me and Phil with a house band, and you know, it was laying on the line, and I was going, okay, we can do something here with the tag where Phil and I can sort of trade like Allman Brothers kind of stuff, right? Never would have been at that point in the one rehearsal that we were going to do for the, you know, Hall of Fame thing to have the guts to say to Phil, let's try this. But because of my experience with Dave, it was like, let's give this a shot. You know, I know this is going to work. This is going to, you know, really be a cool moment, you know, and it was. And at the end of it, Phil just goes, Phil does Phil's thing, you know, and it puts the cherry on the top. And I go, okay, like, so again, I'm looking forward to the rehearsal process, you know, for the new set, because I know there will be things that will happen that will be just kicking my ass in a very good way.
That's exciting. You know, Mike, the three of you guys that are all on this thing today are the architects of what we know as Triumph. And you were not able to be part of the Edmonton thing. So I'm curious for you, what has it been like for you watching this kind of start to take shape? I'll leave it there. What's it been like for you watching this kind of start to take shape the way it has?
I've been looking at the want ads in the newspapers, looking for a job.
Ha
No, I think it's fantastic what's been going on because obviously you don't have the experience with Phil, you know, many years ago, but you know, phenomenal guy, phenomenal player. They've been working together is like unbelievable. And just watching that, you know, and Gil going, living with Gil for the last 6 years. You know, talking about this, and then getting interrupted by COVID, and then getting interrupted by something else, and then something else on top of it. And, so it's been a very long and drawn out pathway, really. So look, I'm not surprised by anything anymore. Nothing surprises me. So, you know, I guess I get to be concert master here now and then, so that's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah, and it's I'm looking forward to it. Like I plan to be when I can, I plan to be at shows. When I can't, I'll be there virtually. So it's
Cool.
not like I'm going to be, you know, down at Joe's Bar playing trivia with my buddies or something. All of this is going to be, you know, an involvement that I'll be very happy with.
Set list, you guys have mentioned the songs. Are there songs that you guys haven't ever done that you've been talking about? Because that's something interesting here, guys, is that certainly I'm sure that there are songs that you guys think about, but obviously having folks like Phil X, Todd, and Brent, anytime you have folks like that are kind of coming in from outside the mix, if we put Phil to the side, people like Brent and Todd are always going to have interesting suggestions because they come into this not only as musicians, but also as fans. So that's kind of cool as well. So I wonder what you guys have been hearing as far as that goes. And Gil, perhaps you can, start with anything you've heard along those lines.
Well, the internet, everybody has an opinion online. And like Phil, has a huge reputation of his own, and so does Todd,
Sure.
and so does Brent. I mean, it's not like those guys are rookies or something,
No. They
but
play with Slash, enough said,
yeah, they got huge gigs,
Those two. Yeah.
they're doing great with their careers, and I attribute a lot of that. Not just are they really excellent musicians and masters of their crafts, but a lot of it is the type of people they are. And when we decided to do this, we evolved our Paul and I evolved the sort of the mixed reality concept, because initially there was a concept where we use actors, and we weren't using what I'll call real musicians, and we're using pseudo musicians. And then Mike Klink, when he recorded our tribute album, and did a phenomenal job on that, and had all the best players in hard rock are on our tribute album. And he one day he just called me, he says, "Gil, like, why don't you and Paul like forget about that idea, and why don't you use some of these musicians here and put together a revised version of the band, augmented this way? And these guys are the best in the world." And I kind of, kind of felt like a dumbbell, and called Paul, and I go, "What are we thinking, man? Like, this has got to be coming off the stage just like as good or better than it ever was musically." So, yeah, we're so focused on the show, and we're not thinking enough about the actual execution of the songs. So that was a game changer right there, which I credit the Klinkster in that regard. And then, of course, the first question is, well, where do you start? And well, there's only one place to start. All roads lead to Phil. We just pick up, kind of where we left off with him, and get him with Rick, and see, if those guys, hit it off, which obviously worked out very, very well. And then when it came to the other two musicians, and Phil said, "Well, who do you want to get? It's up to you." And I said, "No, it's not up to me. It's up to you." I said, "You're there, and you have the experience now that's current." And I said, "I only have one thing, Phil. They just got to be great people. It's one thing if they can play, that's fine. All of them are great players, like on that list. There's no slouches." But I said, for me, it's more about, how's everyone going to be backstage? They have good sense of humor, because they're going to need one. We don't want part super party animals. We want guys that really want to put on a professional, well-orchestrated show, no shenanigans, right?" And he said, "I got the guys. They're just the greatest guys." And then he started telling me about Brent and Todd, and I said, "Sounds fantastic." It was a crazy fluke of this whole thing, Matt. They're Canadians. So you got Phil's a Canadian, Brent's a Canadian, Todd's a Canadian, and of course the three of us. So we're the, kind of the first six-man power trio of all time.
That's fantastic. Yeah, and I mean to have Rick, obviously, I mean to have monster singers like Todd and Phil, I mean doesn't
Yeah.
suck, as they say.
Well, there was a moment where we were in the trailer before we went on in Edmonton, and it was like, "Let's do a little warm-up, vocal warm-up," and we sang the chorus of "Lay It on the Line." And I think Wendy or somebody, Gil, like somebody filmed it, and so we have this, and it was this moment where here's these guys singing these backgrounds. The background vocals had never sounded so good. No disrespect to Mike, and Gil, but it was like, oh. And so now you asked about material, and I don't know if we're going to be going, crazy B cuts from albums or anything, but I do think that songs like, oh, "Lay It on the Line," "Follow Your Heart," "Somebody's Out There," "Fight the Good Fight," the background vocal things you can do are going to be, I'm planning in my head already. Oh yeah, we can do a breakdown, and we can have a, like an Eagles Seven Bridges Road moment where there's just these incredibly rich, big background vocals, which was never, a live thing for Triumph in a big way, but with this, set of musicians, oh man, the potential is, and that kind of stuff gives me goosebumps even just to be thinking about it and contemplating it. I'm going, oh no, this is going to be, I can't wait.
Let me ask you a songwriter question, Rick, because you brought up Somebody's Out There, and that was, and this really goes to all of you guys, but that was extraordinary to me because now these days you can pull up like the top 10 most streamed songs by fans on Spotify. And Somebody's Out There for a long time felt like one of those songs that was underrated in the Triumph catalog, but that's like number seven, number eight. I mean, it's somewhere in the lower half of the top 10 as far as the most streamed Triumph songs. It was cool to see that. So are there songs from your catalog that you are surprised that either they have endured in that way and become perhaps more popular or just endured the way they have?
Well, I'm kind of like Mike in that nothing surprises me anymore, and what, if you've lived long enough, you're not really surprised very much. But I think that you write a song, it kind of takes on its own character and personality out there in the world sometimes if you're lucky. And I've played enough gigs, and I'll tell you know, I just went and did a thing down in Cancun where, it was like an MTV nostalgia weekend thingy resort, and people have been doing this for 7 or 8 years, and it's like, hey, Rick, you want to come down this year? And okay, and so, and when you get out on stage and with an acoustic guitar and you're playing a song, like there's a group of women leaning over the barricade at the front, and these are no longer, young ladies, these are now, let's say middle-aged, and they're screaming, "Oh, World of Fantasy, Rick! You got to play World of Fantasy!" And I'm going, "Yeah, well, there were some songs that got airplay in some places where then people feel like that's the soundtrack of their life, and this was a giant hit." I don't know, you would have a better idea of where World of Fantasy fits in the top 10 or not. Is it in there?
It's not in there, which that surprises me that you mentioned that.
Well, because you maybe grew up in a place where they did play it, but there were other cities where it didn't get rotation and it didn't get airplay, and Triumph didn't play it very much in the sets. And then when I went out for decades on my own, I never played it. And the other thing is, I can't hit it anymore. It's just way too high. But it was one of those songs where if you don't really play it in D minor on the guitar, it doesn't really sit right. You can't really transpose it to a different key. Some of the other songs you can, right? So these are the things that you're sort of pinwheeling around in your head, like what should come from the set list or not, and World of Fantasy is not on the list, and I have to say to the lady at the barricade, "I'm sorry, I don't do that one anymore. Pick another one, And often they will pick Somebody's Out There. I can do that one, I'll give you a little of that. So, yeah, it's sometimes a question of my own ability to hit the notes. But of course, now we got Todd and Phil, and so we've got options now, So when you ask me about specific things on the set list, I gotta go, well, we gotta, work through our options and see what's gonna, feel more powerful than something else. In the end, those are the choices you make.
Yeah, I think if you look at the Spotify top 10, it's pretty gratifying. It's a lot of what we've always known. Lay It on the Line is number one. Magic Power, number two. Fight the Good Fight, number three. Lay It on the Line actually gets a fourth slot just because you have the version that's on the Greatest Hits album, and then they have streamed the version on the record. And then Fight the Good Fight gets another slot in Magic Power, and then Hold On pops in there, followed by Somebody's Out There and Follow Your Heart. So there's a lot of the old war horses that we've all come to know and love there, just looking at it from a data standpoint.
Yeah, and I don't mean to dominate this conversation over the other guys, but I will say this. There's no point in going out on a tour like this where you disappoint people and you
Sure.
don't get out the war horses. Like those songs, there's kind of like a core thing there of those songs, and that forms the spine of what your set's going to be. You can't avoid that. Having said that, you try to find ways for those things to be fresh and interesting, because they got to be fresh and interesting for us. I've been playing them for decades. I want to have fun. That's why I'm going out. So you're trying to meet the audience halfway. The set list will be one of those kinds of things for sure.
I have just a few other things, you guys. And one element of the upcoming tour is that it allows you to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the first album from 1976. And as I was listening to that record yesterday, 24 hours a day still sounds so amazing. You see why so many fans, including, as we know now, future Skid Row singer and massive Triumph fan Sebastian Bach, fell in love with this band from the get-go. It has always kind of struck me that there's not a lot of bands that come out sounding so fully formed like you guys did with a song like 24 Hours a Day. How do you guys look back on that time period? I guess, Mike, perhaps we'll start with you if you want to grab that one.
I guess we recorded all the songs we had. That's pretty much, I don't think we had anything else to record. Correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but I think that was it. We didn't have any boundaries, and we were still early enough in the whole FM progressive hard rock arena, so to speak, on the airwaves that you could pretty much get away with anything if it was good enough. So we weren't really overly concerned that, there was some good heavy rock on it, Street Fighter, 24 Hours a Day when it rocked, and but some blinding light shows there, and it was we're making an album. It's like we've been together for less than a year, and we're making a goddamn album, and in a first class studio. So life is good, if you know what I mean. Couldn't get much better than that.
Yeah.
There was a very, very good pinball machine there too.
That's fantastic. That doesn't help to keep somebody focused, but pinball is fun. I will say that. Rick, Mike brings up something interesting, and that is it was a quote that I saw from you, I think an interview around 2016 or so. And this kind of surprised me to read this as a longtime fan, but basically what you said was that you said Triumph never went into the studio with a wealth of material. You guys always needed songs. And I think that people that have followed this band for a long time and have heard the albums would just assume that you guys were pretty well fixed with song ideas every time you would go in the studio. As I thought more about it, like it makes sense to me, as much as you guys toured, as hard as you guys worked just generally, that's the classic thing that every band ran into back in the day was having to go in to do an album, but you just came off the road. So it's not like you've sat around just writing away. So that's kind of interesting perspective that you put it out like that. That just I think it kind of pulled back the curtain a little bit, something that perhaps people might not have known about Triumph all those years.
Well, Mike just alluded to the temperature of the times where Triumph was starting. We were already 75. The transition from AM radio run music business to an FM kind of model, FM radio, where it was more about albums than it was about singles. But there was always this thing. It didn't matter what band you were in. At some point, it's like, well, what are we going to use as a single? What are you going to use as a lead track? What are you going to, a focus track? So there's always that. You got to have focus tracks that always existed. But Triumph was not really, at a certain point in time, maybe we got two albums in. Like even, let's go back to 24 Hours a Day. I think Gil had sort of come up with this, everybody party 24 hours a day. And Gil did come up with like riff rocky kinds of songs. But I came out of a progressive rock band kind of background, and I was going, I'm thinking like Brian Wilson on his drugs, sitting at his piano in his living room where he had sand as the he had a beach under his piano, so in his bare feet he could be sitting there. Like I'm one of those kinds of guys where I'm going, yeah, his song 24 Hours a Day. What if I had a little, dreamy little thingy that I wrote for the front end that would be like an introduction, and it would be this soft, tinkly thingy. And I don't say 24 hours a day, but the lyric is sort of about, oh, this guy, he's obsessed, which I think that's what Sebastian Bach, he kind of goes, yes, this is me. I'm obsessed with 24 hours a day. I'm living and breathing this stuff, So Triumph at its inception had this thing of, well, Rick kind of wants to float like a butterfly, and Gil wants to pound like the hammer of the gods. And Triumph is going to have this kind of thing that the songs are going to be making these shifts, you know. And even now we're putting set lists together. And I go, well, let's see. Lay It on the Line starts tinkly, tinkly. Magic Power starts tinkly, tinkly. Hold On starts tinkly, tinkly. Even Fight starts tinkly, tinkly. And by the way, just so that I can add this, Gil was the guy sitting at a piano in the studio playing near, 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 gling, 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 gling. I don't know where to go now. I wrote this little sequence thing and I don't know what to do now. And I go, that's great. No, no, that's great. I'll figure out how we can loop it. Don't worry, you know. So, but the tinkly, tinkly part of Triumph was something that informed the creative process. So we, you know, back to your question, there were always little bits. There were always little things, but they were never like full size because we weren't a band that went like, yes, let's sit down and write a focus track. Let's sit down and write a hit single. We weren't like that. And we certainly never did it as a unit where it was like, yes, let's sit down and write this pop song. You know, I mean, fascinating to see the Beatles on those, the Peter Jackson footage.
Oh, yeah.
So you can see the process of these guys. This is how they're coming up with songs. And you're going, man, that's not the way Triumph, you know, that's not the way our process worked. Of course, we weren't Lennon and McCartney. You know what I mean? Like that's part of it too. So, yeah, you know, process is a weird thing. We were always looking for things that would be heavy because we wanted to have the large arena experience. That was Triumph's DNA, was about we're going to put on a show. So you needed stuff that would be soundtrack for putting on a show, you know. So now it's nice to go back and we're mining that set list where the, you know, that repertoire and going, yeah, okay, so where are we going to float and where are we going to hammer, you know, like.
Yeah, I mean, that's an important point. And Gil, let's talk about that yin and yang, because it's like we see that with certain bands from the 70s and 80s that had, like, say, two different songwriters that each brought an interesting thing. Not so much songwriters, but vocalists. I'm thinking of Night Ranger. Like, Kelly Keegi had a certain grit that he brought to the songs that was different than what Jack Blades brought vocally to the songs. And I can make that same kind of visualization in my head and with my ears when it comes to how you approached a song versus how Rick approached songs. So what did you kind of appreciate about that yin and yang that developed between what the two of you were doing across the years?
You know, necessity was the mother of invention. I didn't intend to sing, but you know, Rick was very good on vocals, but it was too hard in a power trio when we were rehearsing for him to play all of the fast solos and all the guitar parts and sing all those songs that were so, a lot of them so high, over and over and over again. And this actually started in a band before Triumph. I'd do the same thing. So I was like a relief pitcher in baseball, you know, when the other guy's arms wore out, that's when you can. And it took me a long time to actually enjoy singing, but you know, over the years I was lucky. I got a vocal coach and I enjoyed it, but the yin and the yang, I think if you took any of, you know, Rick's background in progressive music and his propensity to dig into every other kind of, whether it's classical guitar or jazz guitar or flamenco, if you take that out of Triumph, you wouldn't have Triumph, just have another rock band. And I think the, you know, kind of vive la difference, like we had all kinds of great, you know, hard rock, you know, thunder crashing, this and that and the other thing in our music. But I think it was also the really delicate, quiet, introspective moments, and there were many in Triumph concerts that people loved. Yeah, I wouldn't change that complexion. I've said many, many times, Mike and I were bluesmen, so we came at it from the standpoint of rhythm. And you know, all you have to do is listen to Booker T and the MGs, or you know, those sorts of, you know, the beginnings of soul, you know, like the late great Steve Cropper, who just died last week. That's where we started. And Rick was coming from a different space And that was kind of a really cool, I think, combination of musicians that led to these songs being so diverse, really, in their styles. I think made maybe Triumph have a bit of a unique signature that people liked.
Mike, I'll go to you. That is just it, the unique signature, as Gil says, because he mentioned Booker T and the MGs, but because of that unique signature, Triumph sounds different than Booker T and the MGs, and that is obviously the sum of the parts for each of those groups. And so it has to be interesting for you as you look back at the catalog now and you get a chance to listen to these songs to hear how you and Gil and Rick collectively and individually drove where these songs went, because you three were all there as these were taking shape from the initial song ideas, as Rick said at one point, to finish songs. And that's for people that don't get that deep into the music, that's quite a journey taking them from those embryonic song ideas to the finished, mixed, multi-track record.
That's an understatement if I've ever heard one. But nonetheless, it's some songs end up being like going for root canal, and other songs, you just enjoy working them through. Or in some cases, Rick would bring it, lay it on the line. It was fully written, fully exposed, fully arranged. We just sat down, played it a couple of times, and recorded it. So it didn't need any work. But some songs were very tough, and they turned out really good. Magic Power was a very tough song for us to do, as I'll never forget. It was just miserable. How do we make this sound like Triumph? And I think somebody might have even been me said, "Well, let's try and make it sound like The Who." Maybe
Wow.
that'll, But sometimes the journey is more exciting than the oh, the exit row, so to speak. As you watch a song grow, it's like an idea will come up. Let's try this. Lay this down. Let's try this guitar lick. Let's change the bass part. Let's change the kick drum. Let's do whatever. That's the kind of the hard work part of being in the studio, but also a ton of fun of the experimentation, where you're learning things as you go along.
I think some fans might be surprised, and Rick, maybe you could speak to this a little bit more, but just what Mike just laid out there kind of sounds like we talked about the Get Back documentary. And of course, one of the moments of the Get Back documentary was how we see, I think it's the song Get Back, just emerge in what seems like 20 seconds. So it sounds like Lay It on the Line was kind of the Triumph version of that Beatles moment. What was it that was so complex in your memory as far as when it came to Magic Power?
A lot of Triumph songs start out with arpeggiated kinds of, they're almost like folk songs, tell you sweetly now, I can't come to bed, something's at the edge of your mind, you don't know what it is. They're these floaty kinds of things. And then eventually they're going to get to a point where the song is going, bang, 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 which is very Who. So, but how does that journey, the road that the song's going to have to walk, how do you get there, And I remember this about Magic Power, that it wasn't working for me until in my head, and I am this kind of a guy. So, for example, back to Lay It on the Line, I the first time I was when I was writing, I was hearing these background vocals, like I could hear it in my head. It's got to sound like Queen. It's got to be big. Mike says, "Well, we'll get some girls in. We'll get them to sing background vocals, and we'll make it huge." I'm going, "Okay, yeah, because that's what it's got to be." Now back to Magic. What I was hearing in my head was a very Deep Purple kind of thing. I wanted, I you know, do you remember when John Lord would like just lean on the keys and it would be like this? And I'm
Oh,
going,
yeah.
"Mike, we got to get a Hammond organ and we got to get you to do it." And he hated it. We were ruining his hands. But it was this session where he was, playing these parts. So, and the organ to me is one of the things that makes magic. really good, like as a record, as you know. Now you go out on the road, well, who's going to play the organ part? Because you got to have an organ, and we didn't have an organ. And so there was frustrations that I would have, like, no, we got to have some of this stuff that makes it be like the record, you know? And I blame Led Zeppelin for that, that Jimmy Page would be this guy that would, you know, hear these textures and these layers, and it was much more than, they were essentially a power trio with a guy out front singing, right? And yeah. So how do you make that happen, you know? So that's why I'm looking forward to the whole idea of Todd and Brent. You know what I mean? Like, we're going to be able to realize these songs in a way that maybe they never were realized fully before live on stage, which I find that really, really intriguing.
Why do you think Lay It on the Line was so immediate by comparison?
Honestly, I think it's just something that you kind of hope for when you're writing songs, but and sometimes they just, you're like a radar dish and it comes out of the universe and it arrives and you're going. And the idea was, here's a guy, he's talking to his girlfriend and he goes, I don't ask for much. The truth will do just fine. Like that line of lyric, I think captures the essence of a guy and a girl having this, you know, conversation about their relationship. So how many pop songs are relationship songs? Almost all of them, right? So right away, oh, this is, you've kind of struck gold, right? But now you get to the chorus and it goes, bang, lay it on the line. You know, and it's got these power chords with this hook that's just going to go, here's the hook again, here's the hook again. But now it's going to build, don't waste my time. Like, so it's got this capper line that comes that's like, oh, it's the payoff, you know. Every country song ever written has the payoff, you know. Where, so it was just serendipity that it came together the way that it did, you know. Which is why Gil and Mike go, yeah, yeah, no, this is, it's a done deal. And then you put it out and radio goes, oh yeah, this is a no-brainer. Yeah, this is great, you know. So that thing happens. Then as soon as people are driving in their car, they're listening to the radio, they hear the song, they go, oh, I love this song. This is great. You know, turn it up. And that dynamic hasn't changed for 50 years. So that when a guy that likes Triumph cuts together a hockey commercial, for, you know, to advertise the Stanley Cup playoffs, but he puts it together so that the song is making the footage pay off of guys crashing into each other and guys screaming because they scored a goal, like that, all of that pacing, all of that energy, all of that timing, the song works, you know, and
yeah,
you hope and you pray for it, Matt, but it doesn't always happen. You know, sometimes you're batting 2 out of 10 instead of 3.
Well, guys, as we move towards wrapping up here, Gil, I'll put this to you. You mentioned this in some form earlier, but I appreciate that Phil X is part of this. It brings the two eras of Triumph together in an interesting way, and it feels like this allows for proper closure. It's absolutely bonkers to me that it's been close to 4 decades since you guys last did a show or last did a proper tour with Rick. And on the other side of things, this kind of allows for a different ending for what you guys started but did not necessarily finish with Phil. So it's got to feel good, the different elements of closure that you get to have happen as a result of the way you all are venturing out with this next thing in 2026.
Yeah, you'd have to say Mike and I are pretty good at picking guitar players, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would. Good point.
So the important thing, Matt, was for them to play together. That's what I couldn't wait for, because you know, I just thought the two of them together would be like, I don't know, just rocket fuel. And yeah, that's pretty much what happened. It's pretty much what happened. So it was nice to watch from back on the drum kit, I can tell you that.
Let me put this over to you guys. Do you look at the possibility of new music at all?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Well, you know, we'll talk about it. You know, one of the things about Triumph is, you know, nothing comes quickly. Usually these kinds of things, they take a long time to sort of, you know, go to subcommittees and So we'll see. Who knows? You know, we live in a time where new music is, it's not as important as the, you know, the going out on the road and playing, you know. So, but it is logical, isn't it? If you're going to go out on the road, the idea of there should be an album as part of it. I saw somebody saying this about the Rush thing. Well, they're going to announce the album any day now, you know, like, oh, there's going to be a new album. And you go, yeah, is there? I don't, you know, who knows? Like, I don't know if it's in the cards for us. You know, time will tell that one.
All right, guys, this has been lots of fun. I appreciate the time from all three of you, and I can speak as a fan and the world, I suppose. We are all looking forward to 2026 and glad that you guys get an opportunity to do this. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Thanks, Matt. It was fun talking to you, man.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.